From Washington, VOA presents Issues in the News.
On the panel this week, Laura Meckler, staff writer for The Wall Street Journal, and Tom DeFrank, contributing editor to The National Journal. Our moderator is the White House correspondent for West Wing Reports, Paul Brandis.
Hello, and thank you for joining us. Here are the issues. Breaking with decades of tradition, President Donald Trump says the United States now recognizes Jerusalem as the capital of Israel. The highest court in the United States, the Supreme Court, hears a case involving gay rights and a wedding cake. We'll tell you what that's all about. And a powerful politician, a member of the United States Senate, is quitting after being accused of sexually harassing women. Also, a giant plan to overhaul the federal tax code is nearing completion. The stakes for companies and individuals are big, complicated, and controversial. Let's begin with this decision, very controversial by President Trump regarding Jerusalem. He now says it, and not Tel Aviv, is the capital of Israel. It breaks with decades of American foreign policy, and the reaction around the world has been mostly and highly negative. Tom DeFrank, I'll start with you. Why is he doing this?
Well, I think at its core, it's basically ticking off yet another campaign pledge. President Trump said he would do this if he were elected president. He's done it. It is controversial, but it is very popular with many, many millions in his political base. And as he has gotten into a little more difficulty with the special prosecutor on an entirely different subject, alleged collusion by some members of his campaign staff with the Russians, alleged. He's turning to, in many respects, he's turning to shore up his base, especially evangelicals, and friends of Israel. I mean, President Trump is a big backer of Israel, a big supporter of Prime Minister Benjamin Netanyahu, who stands to gain some political credit for all of this. But basically, for Trump, it's appealing to his base. Another example in his view of promises made and now a promise kept, although it's not clear at all when or if this ultimately will happen, because as you suggested, there's a lot of opposition around the world.
Laura, President Trump said at the beginning of his presidency that it would be, quote, easy to bring peace to the Middle East, quite a boast even from him. And the global reaction, as we've noted, has been highly negative to this. How does this impact whatever even exists of the peace process?
Right. Well, that's our first question, is there even a peace process underway, which I don't think there is much of a peace process underway. That said, this certainly doesn't help the situation. It obviously doesn't help the situation because one of the issues to be determined in the course of those talks, if they ever really get truly underway again, is the status of Jerusalem. The Palestinians also claim East Jerusalem as their capital. So the fact that the United States, which is, you know, wants to be the broker of these talks, comes in and essentially says, well, we recognize Jerusalem as capital of Israel, that makes everything all the more difficult. It makes it harder for the U.S. to play the role it has traditionally tried to, and sometimes in history has succeeded in playing as a broker of Middle East peace. So it is definitely harmful to the peace process to the extent that there is one. It also, in his talk, and some of his supporters, you know, point to this, that he said in his remarks, he's not prejudging that issue. All issues will be on the table when the parties are ready to negotiate them, and that he still believes in a two-state solution. But it's just kind of hard to see how we get from here to there. I mean, personally, I thought it was hard to see how we get from here to there before this happened. And now it just feels like it's, you know, thrown more gasoline onto the fire.
He said back in the spring, in fact, that he would favor, I'm not sure he knows what he wants. He said, well, either a two-state solution or a one-state solution. I just want a deal. That's what he said. Does he even know what he wants?
Well, I don't think that this is the kind. He's not exactly like an expert on the intricacies of the Middle East, and I don't think he pretends to be one. I think I just want a deal. He's called it the ultimate deal. You know, I think that he views himself as being able to just as make an agreement, get it no matter what, get to yes no matter what the matters will be. That's how he sees himself. He doesn't see himself as an expert on the Middle East. He
but
sees
yes
himself
to
as
what?
An expert on deal making. Yes to what? Well, who knows? I mean, at the end of the day, though, my view has always been that what the U.S. wants or the U.S. president wants is a lot less important than what the parties to the actual matter at hand want. I mean, the U.S. can play a role in facilitating it. They have to be willing to make the tough compromises needed to actually bring this about. I mean, and we haven't really been seeing that from either side anytime lately. There was a prominent Palestinian who said in response to what Trump's announcement about Jerusalem that maybe it's time for a one-state solution where Palestinians have voting rights, which of course would undermine Israel as a Jewish state, and not something that Israel neither side would really support that. But that's the kind of thing you didn't really hear before. So you just really don't know where this is going to go.
Okay, to be continued. Let's turn our focus now here at home to the Supreme Court. That, of course, is the highest court in the United States, the final authority on what is or is not constitutional. And it heard arguments in a case involving two men in the state of Colorado who got married. Now, same-sex marriage is legal in this country, and I think in about 24 countries around the world. That's not the issue. The issue, though, is they wanted a wedding cake, and the baker who they went to said, I'm not going to bake you a cake. They sued, and now the case has gone to the court. Actually, I'm going to start with you on this one, Laura. Can you explain this?
Well, it was at the time, one thing that's interesting to note, at the time of this case when these men wanted to get married, same-sex marriage was not in fact legal in Colorado where they lived. They were getting married in Massachusetts where it was legal, but they wanted to have a party, a reception in Colorado, and this baker said no. So what this case really comes down to, but we should say, of course, in the time since then, the Supreme Court issued a ruling mandating that same-sex marriage be allowed in all 50 states. So now that's the nation's rule. And I think that truly most Americans, even those who are uncomfortable with this for a long time, have come around to this. The public opinion on the issue of gay rights and gay marriage has swung rapidly to a large acceptance. That said, there are the people who oppose it have changed their tact and have changed their perspective on this to trying to focus on religious freedom. In other words, okay, fine, you want to get married? I have the right to my religious freedom. And this baker, this is against his own sense of morals, his own sense of what is right and what is wrong. He doesn't have to participate in it. And the issue at hand is what he's doing by making a cake free speech? Is this an expression of himself, because a cake is a work of art? Is this like painting a painting or like writing an essay? Is that what this is? Is this a personal freedom of expression? And he shouldn't be forced to express a cake, essentially, to celebrate something he doesn't believe in? Or is this just everyday goods and services? And, you know, someone's buying something the same way that they would, you know, buy a newspaper. You can't say, well, we're not going to sell a newspaper to gay people because we don't like what you think. You wouldn't be allowed to do that. So that's the question that is before the court.
And it's also beyond the free speech angle, which is very interesting, Tom, sort of this issue of separation of church and state, which from the very founding of this country has been a very controversial issue. Talk about it from that standpoint.
Well, that's the fundamental conflict here between the First Amendment, freedom of speech, or I should say freedom of religion versus gay rights. It's really going to be a landmark case, and it appears to be yet another very too close to call. I would guess it's going to be a 5-4 decision, split decision. And as often is the case in recent years, Justice Anthony Kennedy, who is the swing vote. And court watchers came away unclear about how the court is going to rule. Some court watchers said, well, everybody seems to say there was cause for happiness on both sides. And of course, justices of the Supreme Court are pretty inscrutable, but they often ask questions that give aid and comfort to one side, and then they vote in a different way. So there's no way to know, but I think it's going to be very close. And, of course, the Trump administration is come down on the side of freedom of religion. Once again, that side of the argument appeals to many in the Trump base. And it will just be fascinating to see how this one comes about, because this is the first real, honest-to-goodness landmark case that's being addressed by the Supreme Court since President Trump was elected. So it'll be very interesting to see what sort of a precedent it may or may not set.
There's sort of a general view, for better or worse, that President Trump is somewhat regressive on social issues like this. What are his views on gay marriage in general?
Well, he's always said he's very tolerant, and I think basically he is tolerant, but he understands that for many in his base, especially evangelical Christians, gay rights is anathema to them. And he is very much these days into trying to prop up his base, make a case that he's methodically going about keeping promises he made during the campaign, moving the capital to Jerusalem, which I'm not sure will ever happen, is certainly one of them, and this court case is as well. He is, I think, in his heart, he is more tolerant than you would think, given some of his rhetoric. But at the moment, he's worrying about his base, not about his heart. He's worrying about his political head at the moment.
All right. Well, let's pause here for a short break. More issues in the news in just a minute.
This program is coming to you on the Voice of America in Washington. And a reminder that Issues in the News is available for free download on iTunes. Just click on the iTunes tab on our website at voanews.com. And don't forget to like us on Facebook. Current Affairs with Carol Castiel. Now back to our panel. Laura Meckler, staff writer for The Wall Street Journal, and Tom DeFrank, contributing editor to The National Journal. Our moderator is Paul Brandis, the White House correspondent for West Wing Reports.
Well, we were just talking a minute ago about a big case at the Supreme Court. Well, right across the street from the Supreme Court is the United States Capitol, where one of the most powerful politicians in the country, a senator from the state of Minnesota, Al Franken, said that he is resigning after being accused of sexually harassing women. Laura, this is an issue that has snared all sorts of powerful men in this country in recent weeks, in the media, journalism, Hollywood, and so forth. This is the highest-ranking politician, though, I believe, to actually lose his job, although we're not quite sure when he's resigning, but he said that he would. What's going on here?
Well, there's a reckoning going on big time in this country over the treatment of women by men in the workplace and elsewhere. It's kind of frightening, the number of accusations that have come out against so many prominent people across our public life. What's happening in politics is interesting. There have been everybody up to the president of the United States has been accused. Let's not forget there are 20 women who have accused the president of harassing or unwanted sexual advances, touching them in uninvited ways. And he himself, of course, was heard on tape bragging about this. That all came out during the campaign. He was elected nonetheless, as he'll be the first to tell you. What seems to be happening is that the Democrats are a lot more willing to grapple with this and insist that their leaders step down when these things come up. We had John Conyers, who was a very senior member of the House from Michigan, a Democrat. He resigned. Now we have Al Franken from Minnesota, whose transgressions appeared to be offensive, although perhaps not as serious as what you've heard from some other people. And he has now said he's resigning. Meanwhile, as he pointed out, as Senator Franken pointed out in his speech, in Alabama, we have the Republican candidate for the U.S. Senate who has been accused of really, really disturbing allegations of sexual assault and harassment and approaching teenagers, you know, girls as young as 14, trying to date them, trying to kiss them, in one case, actual sexual assault. And there was in the party, the Republican Party, after sort of being uncomfortable with it for a bit, is now back to fully embracing him, from President Trump, who's endorsed him officially. The RNC, the Republican National Committee, is backing him. So there is definitely a disconnect right now in what's going on in Washington between how the two parties are handling this. Obviously, the offense is not limited to one party or the other, but the ramifications do seem to be disparate.
Tom, Laura touched upon something interesting. The, you know, the Democrats are kind of tossing their people overboard here. She did mention John Conyers, the most senior member of the House of Representatives, 88 years old, I believe, who resigned rather quickly, and now Senator Franken. Politically, how does that play out when one party decides to get rid of these deplorables, for lack of a better term, and the Republicans embrace theirs?
Well, the Democrats are gambling by taking a hard stand on sexual assault and sexual harassment, that they, the Democrats, will get the better of the political argument. And also it's a way, in the Democratic view, to refocus the pressure on President Trump. As Laura mentioned, he's got a lot of women who have accused him of inappropriate behavior. By the time Issues in the News is back on the air, we will know whether Roy Moore, the Republican candidate from Alabama, has won or lost. I happen to think it's a lose-lose for the Republicans, whether he wins or whether he is defeated. But we'll know, and it'll begin sorting out somewhat. I mean, the political problem for the Republicans is they have a very slim two-vote majority in the United States Senate. If Moore were to lose, they're down to one vote. It's a political calculation on the Republicans' part, and I think the Republicans seem to be thinking that this will blow over. I don't think it's going to blow over. I think there are going to be more members of Congress who have to resign because, to use the old cliche, the genie is out of the bottle here on the question of sexual harassment. And it all began with the Harvey Weinstein allegations, which forced him out of his firm. Weinstein was one of the great Hollywood deal makers and movie makers. He is gone. His company is dissolved. And that seems to have empowered, and I think appropriately so, a lot of women who feel like the climate is right to not stay silent anymore. And so the notion that this is all going to go away once we have an election in Alabama is not realistic.
And Laura, the fact that women comprise the biggest slice of the electorate, the people who vote in this country, you mentioned President Trump, then candidate Trump, was accused of this in 2016. He was elected nonetheless. But now, as Tom said, the genie is out of the bottle. Looking ahead to 2020, that's still quite a ways off. But how can President Trump sort of avoid all of the attention on him? He denies that he did anything, but what about that?
Well, what about it? Well, you know, we'll see. I mean, if you're asking me, will these allegations bring him down in 2020? You know, I have no idea. I mean, we'll have to see what's happening then. I mean, I don't think it's helpful for him by any means, but you know, he has a lot of problems going into 2020, at least as we sit here today. So, I mean, you know, Tom mentioned how he's, you know, doubling down and working to appeal to his base. That's partly because they're kind of the only ones who are with him right now. His approval rating is in the 30s across many polls. So that is that's historic lows for a president at this point in his term. So, or maybe even at any point in one's term. I'm not sure. So he's really has a lot of problems going for him right now. Will this ultimately catch up with him? A lot of Democrats right now are angry, very angry, and feeling like it's a total double standard and the thing is that the Democratic Party has long stood for the rights of women. So they can't really say, well, he's in office, so our guy gets to stay in office. It's like that would be hypocritical on their own part. I don't think that it's only a political calculation on the part of the Democrats that they'll get the better argument at the end of the day. I think it's something they truly believe in. And for the Republicans are now in this very uncomfortable position. Will they ultimately have to reckon with it? You know, I don't know, truthfully. And you know what? If Roy Moore wins this election, that will just be more proof for the Republican Party that, hey, we can weather these storms.
It's interesting also, Laura touched on this earlier, the White House, the chief White House argument seems to be this issue has already been litigated. These charges were made against candidate Trump. People discounted them and elected him anyway. Well, you could also say, well, Senator Franken was elected as well. Congressman Conyers was elected as well.
But they didn't know about these charges at the time. I mean, that would be the argument against that. But I mean, so what if they've been litigated before would be my answer to that. It's like, does that mean it doesn't matter? I mean, he obviously won the election for a lot of reasons. That doesn't make these things go away. But whether they're, you know, also, you know, by the time 2020 comes around, they're definitely going to be calling that old news. So.
Well, the term litigated, by the way, suggests some kind of a legal process which has not occurred here. I think litigated perhaps in terms of public opinion.
Right, but, of course.
Well,
exactly.
I only mentioned the L word because that is the word that the White House press secretary constantly uses.
All right. Well, we've got to move on here. For the first time in decades, the federal government looks set to overhaul its tax code. It means huge changes, not an understatement. Huge changes in how much companies pay in taxes, how much individuals pay, and there are countless smaller changes, too, that impact literally everything, health care, going to university, buying a car, taking care of your children. Tom, President Trump has not signed any major pieces of legislation yet. He's been president for nearly a year now, but this is about as big as it gets.
Yes, and I think the odds are very strong that he will finally get a piece of important legislation through Congress and signed into law. They're very close. There are lots of differences that have to be sorted out by a conference committee under the U.S. system. A bill from the House and the bill from the Senate has to be agreed upon. It's got to be precisely the same legislation. So that's going to include at least a couple of weeks, maybe longer, of horse trading.
And for people who are listening, they call that a conference.
Conference committee, and it's usually about a dozen or so members from the House and the Senate. And the jockeying is going to be constant. It was really interesting to me that both of these competing versions of a tax bill include eliminating or at least drastically cutting back the deduction for state and local income taxes. And a couple of days ago, President Trump was at a fundraiser in New York, and some of his wealthiest New York friends beat him up, saying, "You're killing us, because if you eliminate this deduction for state and local income taxes, that hurts people in high tax states like California and New York." Neither of which voted for President Trump, but he's from New York, and many of his friends, many of his wealthiest friends, are in New York, and so they're beating him up. I think he's not going to back down on that. But there's all sorts of side shows, side bets, side plays here that have to be resolved. But, I mean, I think in this case, the Republicans are sticking together because they, like Trump, know they need a deal. Because while Trump isn't up till 2020, the Congress is up in 2018, 11 months from now, and they have to have something to show.
Laura, it seems to me there's some sort of a disconnect here. Usually when you want to cut taxes, you do so to stimulate the economy. Now, whether that actually works or not, that's a whole other debate. But President Trump says, well, we need these tax cuts to stimulate the economy. And yet in the very next breath, he says, well, the economy is doing great. The word GDP, gross domestic product, is now growing at 3%. We've got the lowest unemployment rate in 17 years. He brags about this all the time. So why do we need to stimulate the economy with, as he says, these big tax cuts?
Well, I think their answer would be, let's get it growing even faster. Like that maybe we're doing good, but we can do better. I mean, I think the argument from Republicans is that, you know, the centerpiece of this whole package is a huge cut in the corporate tax rate. So they're saying that U.S. companies are not competitive with other companies around the world and that this would change that. So this is more of a fundamental structural change to our corporate tax code. I think that that's the centerpiece. They would argue that that's good to do no matter how the economy is doing. That needs to be fixed. So I think that would essentially be the answer to their their answer to that question.
All right. We're going to have to end it right there. Our thanks to Laura Meckler, staff writer of The Wall Street Journal, and Tom DeFrank. He's contributing editor to National Journal. This program was produced by the Voice of America Current Affairs, our engineer, Justin Thwaites. And I'm Paul Brandis of West Wing Reports. Thank you very much for listening.